Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm one of your hosts, Chad Vlasic. Today, we'll be talking to Kyla Schuler about her book, The Biopolitics of Feeling, Race, Sex, and Science in the 19th Century, from Duke University Press, put out this year. The Biopolitics of Feeling explores issues of race and gender through ideas of sentimentalism and impressibility in evolutionary science of the 19th century, as well as how these concepts were produced and used in literature, medicine, philanthropy, and the social sciences. Kyla critically engages with the theories of Foucault, Deleuze, and new materialist theorists as well. Her books should be of interest to folks in STS, as well as for American studies, gender and sexuality studies, and much, much more. Thank you for joining us, Kyla.
Thanks for having me, Chad.
So, before we get into your book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in this project to begin with?
It started, as many first books do, as a dissertation. I was in the UC San Diego Literature Department, and I was doing, for my qualifying paper, I was looking at the interest in birth control and eugenics of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as also looking at some of the eugenics hopes and dreams of some of the post-revolutionary figures in Mexico in the 1920s, and seeing a lot of similarity between them. And it just made me wonder about what this longer history that these folks, that Du Bois and that these post-revolutionary Mexican leaders were drawing on, where they were turning to what we usually think of as, you know, Anglo-Saxon race sciences, but they're turning to them instead for a framework for anti-racist resistance. And so it made me want to know, like, what is that prehistory, especially once I realized that what they had in common was a Lamarckian framework rather than a Mendelian framework toward eugenics. I wanted to know what is this other tradition of evolutionary science that could be used to oppose racial determinisms. And then that led to seeing just how broadly Lamarckism was taken up in the US 19th century, and how much it shifted many ideas of not only what evolutionary politics look like and reform politics look like, but also even the very nature of race and sex difference as they consolidated in the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea how popular Lamarckianism was like during this era, because the way that evolutionary science is usually taught, the history of it is by the time of the of Darwin coming out with On the Origin of Species, that very quickly or within a couple decades that there was this huge shift, but it took quite a bit longer than that. Lamarckianism wasn't just influencing scientists, it was influencing the sort of broader culture as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that thesis of how Darwinism was embraced, rapidly and fully across the wider culture soon after Origin of the Species came out in 1859, the thesis, a lot of it comes from Richard Hofstadter's work in the 1940s. And it's been tremendously influential and long lasting, but I think from the perspective we're at now, we can actually see how that thesis was in part a moment of his own time. You know, he's writing in the immediate aftermath of the modern Darwinian synthesis. When natural selection theory was merged with population genetics, and suddenly that Darwinian model of evolution by chance, mutation and competition, was really settling in. I think it was easier to project that backwards and say, oh, this has been obviously true since the theory debuted. But the work of historians of science like Bannister and Peter Bowler in the 90s really helped show that that Darwinian revolution actually didn't really happen until the 30s and early 40s. And the 19th century was embracing this Darwinian-Lamarckian mix. And so from my perspective, that work was really helpful because in literary and cultural studies and ethnic studies and gender studies, we've tended to embrace that Hofstadter thesis of social Darwinism was the rule of the day and that competition, you know, brutal competition was enshrined as the order of nature and therefore the order of society in the 19th century. But it was much more complicated than that. And so bringing that history of science work into these other fields really opened up for me a totally different story about biopolitics.
And it's also really relevant for today. I mean, you know, in the introduction, you talk about the politics of Black Lives Matter, and then at the end, you talk about you know, this resurgence in a way of Lamarckianism via epigenetics. So yeah, I was actually wondering what got you thinking about starting off the book with Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, I was really struck by that visual meme that went around, I guess now 3 years ago, that just said Black lives are greater than white feelings, because it seemed to me to be precisely contesting the biopolitics of feeling framework that I, you know, diagnosed and analyzed in the book of how much biopolitics has actually been about a ranking of a relative capacity of feeling, and specifically ascribing full feeling in a both sensation sense and emotional sense to whiteness, and meeting out a lesser capacity for feeling down a racial hierarchy, with the opposite pole being blackness, which was often considered dead material and literally not capable of absorbing and reflecting upon sensation and emotion in order to be able to move forward through time, in order to be able to be affected by those feelings. It was seen as, you know, stuck in the immediacy of the present, trapped in the impulses of immediate sensation. And so when I saw this Black Lives Matter meme really identifying the way that Black feeling is actually key to the larger framework that constructs Black lives as disposable, constructs Black life as not of meaning in the larger nation. I thought it was a great anecdote to start with. And then just to be honest, in a kind of strategic sense, I wanted to start with something from the present, not, you know, the perfect 19th century anecdote, because I do think that the book has a lot to say about contemporary critical theory and political frameworks. And so I wanted a reader who's not necessarily inclined to picking up a book about the 19th century, you know, to be reassured from the very beginning that this would have something to say to them about the present as well.
Absolutely. And speaking of which, and your engagement with the critical theories here, you start off with quite a bit of that. And part of this is dealing with critically engaging with new materialism. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I started this project, say, in 2005, and I was reading all this vitalist race science of the 19th century, you know, especially the subject of what became the first chapter, which is called Taxonomies of Feeling, and that's the American school of Neo-Lamarckians. And they called themselves the American School of Evolution, quite explicitly riffing on the earlier American school of ethnology, you know, the famous polygenist race scientists of the 1840s and 50s. And for them, they had this vitalist perspective where all life down to the tiniest protozoa, the lead scientist Edward Drinker Cope wrote, has the capacity of sensibility, has a vitality, has a vitality that's in every cell. It doesn't just exist in the organism as a whole, but it comes down to the basics of every material component of the body. Where they differ is in which bodies possess the capacity of sentiment or emotional which they understand as an emotional reflection upon a sensation. This capacity of reflection is what drives species change. What drives evolution, which for them was a very teleological process. You know, this is before the Darwinian synthesis. So Darwin is read as outlining a path to progress, not just a process of random variation. So I've been seeing these, the ways that these race scientists were understanding a capacity of vitality and reflection on vitality as driving racial difference and also for them sex difference in really starkly racist and hierarchical ways. You know, their major recommendation for protecting U.S. society was to deny white women the suffrage and to deport everybody of Black descent from the United States because they understood Blackness to be dead material and therefore a contagion to the nation as a whole. It was very clear how the capacity of vitality, although they claimed in some ways that it was universal, it actually ended up being their framework for race difference. So I've been reading this for years, and then suddenly new materialism happened, which often in a kind of ahistorical way claims to rediscover the vitalistic capacities of matter. And so it was just very troubling to me that this wasn't actually a rediscovery as much as a reanimation of an older theory that wasn't actually that old, that was, just preceding the modern Darwinian synthesis in the 30s and 40s, and then in some ways is coming back with epigenetics. And so it's not, of course, that I think that any framework of vital matter is therefore, irrevocably tainted. But I do think that we can't engage with theories of vital matter without really carefully tracing their genealogy and being very clear about how vital matter originated in our modern sense as a framework for race difference, and how when we're invoking it, we're taking it someplace different. But new materialism in general hasn't actually been interested in that genealogy. And in fact, it's often quite deracinated, as if turning to vital matter is a universal that will help solve political dilemmas. By virtue of a new kind of logic of universality. And that is what I really wanted to intervene in.
Yeah, I think it's an incredible intervention in terms of historicizing the movement, if you will. I was wondering, in terms of the American School of Evolution, could you tell us more about their effect or their, their influence over biological thought, evolutionary thought in the 19th century, as well as the very, entertaining and problematic Cope?
Yeah, Cope is a really fascinating figure. He's the most published scientist in U.S. history. He published more than 1,800 articles, as well as two full-length books. And most of those articles were about his paleontology research and comparative anatomy research. But then he also liked to extrapolate from, the biological laws that he was, discovering / inventing into the larger political sphere. So, they were tremendously influential. They were all students of Agassiz, except for Cope's actually. And they, sort of turned against their mentor in embracing evolution. But they thought that Darwinian evolution was validating what Cope called promiscuous variation. And they wanted instead a version of evolution that was orderly, directed by reason and feeling, and that was even more guaranteed to turn out as a teleological path to progress than Darwin was. And Darwin, as I said, was already being read in teleological ways at that moment anyway. But they really wanted a notion of evolution that humans maintain control over species change. And by humans here, I mean that in a race science sort of capital H way, In other words, like those groups that had achieved civilization and were therefore understood to have acquired full humanity. So, you know, as historian of science, Peter Bowler writes that Cope's ideas were taken seriously by every paleontologist of his era. You know, he's most famous to us now for his really outrageous competition he had with O.C. Marsh, you know, what we call the Bone Wars, about who could discover and classify the most prehistoric species. And they did really, you know, they did really outrageous things, including like blowing up each other's train cars full of specimens or dynamiting fossil collection sites, buying up an entire print run of an article of a journal containing the opponent's article so that nobody could see it and therefore it wouldn't have an effect. And this tends to be the story we tell about Cope now. But I wanted to tell a different story about how much his notion of an evolution that works by a mastery of sentiment and that therefore gives the civilized control over species change by virtue of their mastery of the reflection, reflectional capacity of feeling to develop self-control and to mediate upon the following, like, you know, instinctive sensation and impulsive feelings, that this kind of evolution by sentiment, I think, is actually tremendously significant and was embraced by a much wider popular sphere. I mean, you know, everyone from someone like a Harriet Beecher Stowe is also working with a kind of evolution by sentiment, although not with the same kind of scientific framing. You know, so for example, after she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, she actually bought a Florida plantation with the specific goal of trying to train the formerly enslaved people into the habits of civilization through teaching them the arts of cleanliness, promptitude, Christianity, you know, and proper maintenance of a home. It was kind of her own version of the off-reservation boarding school movement that tried similarly to civilize the uncivilized through training them in the habits and feelings and sensations of civilization. Cope was really outlining a specific evolutionary framework for this much broader hope that humans could, that whites could wrest control of civilization and train themselves into perfection and train the uncivilized into positions of servitude where they'd be beneficial to capital accumulation instead of posing threats to capital accumulation.
Absolutely. So in terms of how this idea around sentimentalism and around impressibility, In your second chapter, you get a different interpretation, right? Engaging with Frances Harper and her Black feminist biopolitics, it seems that her response, I guess you could say, is that as a race, you know, speaking as a Black woman, that as a race that the Black population could become less impulsive, right? And so could you speak more on like how she was framing this and in terms of, you know, what influence she had?
Yeah. So the main argument of the book is that biopolitics consolidated in the 19th century US in this sentimental mode about this belief in restraining and training a immediate response to sensation and cultivating these emotional powers of reflection that were understood not just to have an effect on, you know, cultivating individual discipline, but actually because of the broader Lamarckian framework of the 19th century, this process of disciplining sensation was thought to actually achieve regulation of the population. So I'm understanding sentimentalism as this broad technology of regulating the population to ultimately achieve what many hoped would be the arrival of a condition of heavenly perfection on earth. Even folks like Cope were looking toward the evolution of white into perfection. So this framework consolidated this capacity of white perfection through a series of contrasts, which is, you know, precisely how race works, and precisely the point of race's invention within a larger framework of biopower, that it works by identifying elements of the population that are seen as threats to the survival of the whole. And again, you know, survival in this context meaning actual perfection. So blackness was cast in the position of being the greatest contagion to the possibility of the success of the population as a whole. And in particular, you know, because of attitudes to anti-black attitudes that we're familiar with still today, you know, including the idea of a more animal sexuality, you know, a total inability for any kind of impulse control or, you know, delaying gratification toward future reward, such that blackness was considered to be ultimately a problem of time, a problem of being unable to absorb the effects of one's actions and therefore move through time. So the central concept I work with here is the idea of impressibility, which I identify as the capacity to be affected over time. And it's one of those keywords I think that's been hiding in plain sight. It's actually everywhere in the 19th century and even up to the present, but we haven't really excavated it as such. But impressibility is this capacity of the body was understood to be unequally distributed across the races. And it was the physiological potential for progress, that capacity of being affected by a sensation, developing some kind of response to it, and therefore having a modification as a result that would then get transmitted to children. So it's the Lamarckian framework applied much more broadly to the idea of social progress as well. So this put blackness and especially black women in a really hard position because they're denied the basic access to time. I mean, I think that race is a spatio-temporal framework, which locks blackness in a position of being animated fossils, you know, made to move by others, but not able to absorb the effects of their own motions for themselves. So Frances Harper really sort of took the bull by its horns, I think, and engaged in directly with this framework in arguing that the black middle class was developing the capacity of impressibility and was developing this ability to discipline sensation, not just for the good of, you know, an individual moral Christian lifespan, but also for the good of the growth of the race as a whole. And she read a fair amount of heredity theory. She wrote a fair amount of advice to mothers about this is how you cultivate the right kind of sensation and feeling in our children so we can continue to improve the race, which is super important because, you know, she was the best-selling black author of the 19th century. She sold 50,000 books in the first 15 years of her career. It's mostly fiction, but this was precisely a great way to model a kind of didactic approach where she's teaching readers how to upwardly evolve their children through a right kind of Christian evolutionary motherhood. But I also think that she does so in a really interesting way because at least in my initial field, which is 19th century American studies and American literature, she's often dismissed as being horribly sentimental, you know, as way too prudish, horribly anti-sex and way too committed to a kind of hyper respectability politics. But I think that if we understand sentiment not just to be about a politics of saccharine emotion and not just even a feminine politics, which is what much of the feminist recovery of sentiment was about in the 90s, and not only an imperial politics, but actually one of the structures of biopolitics itself, we can see how she's actually engaging directly in the discourse of biopolitics and doing what I call a kind of negotiated biopolitics of engaging exactly with the notion of impressibility and totally changing who counts as impressible, who counts as capable of progress, in a way that she ends up actually also recovering the possibility of Black erotic pleasure. She really drills down on the role of the sensation at the heart of the notion of evolution in order to recover a kind of physical gratification as actually being central to the idea of progress. So I find her a super interesting figure, though I'm certainly not trying to recover her as therefore a fully radical one, you know, because for her, the line is not Blackness and whiteness. For her, the line is the Black middle class is capable of progress and the Black working class is not yet, because their capacity for self-control has not yet been reawakened. So it's absolutely a biopolitics frame, but a position of biopolitics articulated from the role of being cast unto death.
Now, in your third chapter, you deal with more of the side of medicine here with Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell and Dr. Mary Walker. And one, you know, of the many interesting parts about this chapter is, you know, some sight into 19th century queer doctors. The other aspect, of course, is how Blackwell and Walker use this framework of impressibility when it comes to the vagina. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on how exactly did they frame this impressibility of the vagina, and how is it racialized?
Yeah, this was easily my favorite, you know, discovery of in the research of this project. You know, it started out as a chapter about the queerness of many of the early women doctors. You know, Lillian Federman and others have suggested that as many as 70% of the female physicians in the first 80 years since women first started getting medical degrees in the 1850s were unmarried and lived full time with female partners. And so I was really interested in the queer potentials of Lamarckism, you know, because this idea that evolution happens through impressions means that hereditary material doesn't just come from what was later called heterosexual parentage. It means that hereditary material is transmitted in milieus, in environments, in all kinds of social interactions and relations. You know, and this is precisely, of course, why the 19th century had an obsession with degeneration, you know, but right, about how contact with the wrong people, with the wrong social classes, with the wrong neighborhoods would create effects that would actually de-evolve the civilized. But it also means that there's a kind of queer inheritance. It meant that, for example, being a female physician put you in a position of actual generation in relation to whiteness. Elizabeth Blackwell, for example, said, "We are not mothers in the lower physical sense," she said. "We are mothers in a higher sense. We're actually giving birth to a stronger race as a whole." So they saw their work as directly impacting the hereditary material of whiteness. So the eugenic implications of that are massive. And I think an important thing to realize about a lot of these 19th century reform projects, that they're actually invested in literally breeding a better whiteness. And that eugenics built into liberal reform, I think, has not been fully realized because we've been so wedded to the idea that eugenics equals the Mendelian gene and haven't yet been able to see what eugenics under other schemes of heredity look like. But much like Frances Harper was able to turn the theory of impressibility around and find some negotiating room for arguing for the potential of Black womanhood, so did doctors like Elizabeth Blackwell and Mary Walker turn impressibility around and say, okay, if the capacity for nervous sensation and emotional response is actually the heart of the ontology of progress, then we can identify the physical structure, the anatomical part that is the apex of the capacity of impressibility and progress. And that structure is the vagina, which really blew my mind when I found these materials. You know, I had no idea that 19th century women physicians in the 1860s and 70s were even writing about vaginas or rape, especially marital rape, dildos, or any of the number of topics that especially Mary Walker engages in. But they use the framework of impressibility to say, vagina is the most impressible structure of the human nervous system, and specifically the white woman's vagina, because only the civilized have acquired the capacity of impressibility over time. And they say because of this, it's posing a tremendous threat to the racial health of whiteness, that white women have no control over their sexuality, that white women have no self-determination in deciding when they have sex. And so they use impressibility and the impressibility of the vagina to argue for the need, the racial need for white women's sexual self-determination. So again, much like Harper, it's an argument that on the one hand is kind of, you know, really exciting to see feminists in the 19th century arguing for white women's sexual feeling and also arguing against rape. You know, Mary Walker went so far as to say that 50% of all children, she estimated, were born of rape. She said that fathers should teach their daughters to crush rapist testicles with their hands as a, you know, a necessary element of defense. These things are exciting to encounter in an 1860s, 1870s feminist text, but it's all wrapped up in this broader goal of evolving whiteness into eugenic perfection.
And that that continues in the next chapter, where you're dealing then with another just remarkable story. Again, I had no idea about this. The Children's Aid Society by Charles Brace.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, right? This project that transported 200,000 kids from East Coast cities to the West. And I also had never heard of it until I started doing this research. It's weirdly not even part of a standard American studies narrative.
Yeah, and it must just have shaped so much, given how many, were moved around.
Yeah.
And also used for labor. So that was a big part of it, right? So, and the framing of this is that in New York City, explicitly, there's this problem of particularly crime rates and seeing the youth as basically the criminals. And the only way to really get them to not be these impulsive criminals is to put them in an environment, once again, kind of dealing here with the proto-epigenetics, that within this, within this environment and through the labor that they do, that they can gain some self-control. So in terms of that, speaking of which, the children, later on, they, you include some of their accounts, which are just wild. In terms of this, could you say more about Charles Brace and, how he got this, as you call it, biophilanthropy started, in terms of the connection to impressibility.
Yeah. So, it's Brace was a really perfect figure for me because he literally sits at the intersection of the different fields that I'm arguing were so intertwined: sentimentalism, reform, and science. And a lot of that is just for him in his biography. He's cousin to Harriet Beecher Stowe and Catherine Beecher. So he's literally of the family that's now considered, the paragons of 19th century sentiment. His cousin was, another cousin of his was married to Asa Gray, the leading botanist in the US 19th century. which meant that Brace was the second or third person in the U.S. to read Origin of Species when it came out. Because when it came out in November of 1859, Darwin sent two copies to the U.S., one to Agassiz at Harvard and one to Asa Gray. And Brace went to Asa Gray's house for Christmas a few weeks later and read it then, and it blew his mind. And he was actually the person who introduced Darwinian thought to Thoreau and Emerson and the Transcendentalists, who were part of the Boston scene in the 1850s and 60s. And then he also founded what organization still running today, the Children's Aid Society, which evolved into the largest orphanage in New York, but also he's considered the father of modern foster care by developing this project he called the Emigration Plan, which took children out of tenements, especially when he started in New York, but then other copycat organizations did it with other cities, and sent them to send them to farm families in the rural West, where they could be impressed with a new set of characteristics. So in some ways, it's quite similar to the off-reservation boarding school movement, started by Richard Henry Pratt in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, that we're a lot more familiar with. But I wanted to tell the story of the orphan train, one, because it's stunning to me how little we know of it if you're not a U.S. social historian. But then also because he just had this incredibly well worked out theory about why the orphan trains would work to transform criminal prone immigrant children, as he saw them, into disciplined Americans. And that was because of this interest in Darwin. He claims to have read Origin of Species 13 times. He was able to visit with Darwin in England because of his connections with Asa Gray. He published an ethnology in the 1860s in the midst of the Civil War, arguing against polygenesis, as well as other article-length arguments about how environment creates physical racial characteristics and how environmental change, therefore, transforms physical and emotional and mental racial characteristics. So he really believed that by taking kids out of the tenements, that he would change their gemmules. He had a very Lamarckian reading of Darwin. He would change their gemmules and therefore create new hereditary material and transform these kids into Americans. It was 200,000 kids that were transported. They were purposely put in positions of legal limbo. They weren't formally adopted, but they also were cut off from their families. And so there are stories of things like children while riding the trains west, we now call them the orphan trains, riding the trains west, would have a note card in their jacket pocket with their family's address on it, and would wake up after a nap or after a night on the train one day and discover that that card had been taken out of their jacket, that one of the Children's Aid Society's agents had removed it, because the organization went so far as to say that children couldn't contact their families without explicit permission from the society. They really were trying to create a complete break with any contact of their former worlds in order to impress new characteristics upon these kids. In some ways it's considered an enlightened approach, because many thought that, in my terms, many thought that Irish immigrant kids were not impressible, did not have the capacity to change. Brace did. Brace is extending that capacity of vitality and plasticity to immigrants, which was not necessarily the norm, but only in childhood. And that was a not uncommon belief, that impressibility was heightened in childhood, and that if a primitive group had no impressibility in adulthood, they might still have a little bit in childhood. So on the basis of this goal of actually transforming hereditary material, I argue that this project is not just the beginnings of foster care, but we should think of it as the beginnings of a first large-scale eugenics project. And that's because I'm, you know, taking a history of science intervention and saying, if we understand Galton at his word, Galton frames eugenics as the science of manipulating heredity in order to improve the race. You know, he's writing this in the 1880s, 20 years before Mendel's pea plant experiments are rediscovered, and 22 years before the concept of the gene is even invented. So there's no reason that we have to equate eugenics with genetics. But eugenics is about deliberately manipulating heredity on the large, on the populational level of race. And that's what I see happening in the Orphan Train Project with tremendous effects. I mean, I think that actually part of one of the impacts of the Orphan Trains is that this is partly how the Irish were understood to have become white over the second half of the 19th century into the 20th, because he worked predominantly with Irish immigrant children. And explicitly, it's a framework of transporting these immigrant kids to helping to replace indigenous populations in the West. So this project went on from 1854 until 1929. So, you know, just a mind-boggling number of decades and number of children involved. And it wasn't stopped until every state had passed legislation prohibiting the transport of indigent children across state lines. So in other words, I argue that new forms of eugenics that now understood hereditary material to be immutable were replacing older forms of eugenics that understood hereditary material to be malleable to experience. And then the other part, this is also another chapter where the archival work I did was really interesting to me in helping to flesh out this story. And it had a real emotional impact on me as I was doing this work, which is that the New York Foundling has a collection of notes that were found pinned to the clothing of infants that were surrendered on their doorstep, given up for adoption, either. You know, and that those babies would either be raised in New York in the orphanages or would go out on the New York Foundling's own baby trains that they started in the 1870s. But they're just these notes that parents or other guardians or sometimes, you know, police officials or other reform officials would leave, noting sometimes the circumstances of the child's birth, maybe noting a name, maybe not. Often expressing a lot of regret and pain about how they couldn't afford to keep the child. Sometimes just incredibly brief, like one note just says in a perfect quill script, it says only, "Oh, cruel poverty," with an exclamation point. And these notes, I think, are really important records left by families that were you know, victims/survivors of biopolitics, records of folks who were subject to eugenic regimes that had goals that were quite different from their own. They were looking for a way that their child could be fed and not starve. And instead, it gets wrapped up in this project of cultivating whiteness at a nation state level of the race.
In chapter five, we kind of come full circle here because this chapter is primarily focused on W.E.B. Du Bois and basically his engagement with evolutionary thought. And so in terms of his intervention, it's really quite unique and I think understudied. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on how exactly did W.E.B. Du Bois intervene in this transition, that is sort of a transitional period into the early 20th century, from this more, Lamarckian evolution to, the commonly known, eugenics projects.
Yeah. So it is a really interesting period of transition, early 20th century, where I think that sentiment in general is getting stripped of its epistemological power. And it's understood to now sentiment is just about emotional feeling and not about a physical discourse of sensation. Also, it's no longer seen as having a sentiment, is no longer seen as having a role in scientific knowledge, like production, like it was in the 19th century. And along with this shift, you get a stripping away of the possibility of feeling and experience and impressions as having any long-lasting change. You know, that this is the rise of Mendelian genetics, the rise of classical genetics, in which hereditary material is understood to be not only innate, but immutable and impermeable, you know, and to often considered by people like, you know, Davenport, you know, famously a central figure in Anglo-American eugenics, as being incapable of mixing. You know, the hereditary material is so discrete that even, you know, biraciality poses a tremendous problem because distinct racial genes will not mix in his framework. And so Du Bois is writing in this context and seeing a consolidation of genetic determinism happening around him. And he says that he sees that the age of Weissmann, the age of Mendel, the age of Davenport, is working to further lock blackness into a position of an utter lack of potential. That for Du Bois, he's quite explicit that an older Lamarckian framework gave reformers a lot of hope and potential because it meant that changes you make in the present generation won't just affect people currently alive. They will actually have effects generationally over time. And Du Bois really wanted to hold on to this idea. He didn't want to give way completely to the new genetic determinist paradigm. And so I look at a bunch of his writing on evolution and heredity and reform and argue that he embraces a notion of social heredity as this idea that he sort of argues, okay, maybe the physical material component of heredity doesn't change, but that we have a social heredity that we can accumulate and improve upon over time, and that this will help cultivate the races into a position of greater potential. But then he also turns to birth control, I think, as many others did, as a new place of eugenic potential, right? So the part of the shift from Lamarckism to Mendelian Darwinism in terms of reform is a shift from it's a shift in eugenics, and that shift in eugenics is from fighting over who gets to raise the children, who gets to direct children's impressibility, to a new framework of who gets to be pregnant in the first place. If genetics is immutable, then who raises the child doesn't matter so much. What matters is whose fertility is permitted. And Du Bois was really prolific, actually, in writing about the need to curtail Black fertility. And not just writing about it, I also look at the Planned Parenthood archives and his work with the Negro Project of Planned Parenthood in the 40s, which was an experiment in running birth control clinics in South Carolina and Tennessee for Black women, specifically with the goal of reducing the birth rate of the Black working class. And I think that Du Bois had both eugenic and anti-racist aims in that goal. Planned Parenthood did as well, though I think that the anti-racist goals were much smaller for Planned Parenthood. If you look at the archives and notes and things, they're much more interested in reducing the Black birth rate, full stop. Whereas for Du Bois, he really sees it as a possibility of material advance. But it's very top-down. It's very elite-led. So it feels much more like a kind of eugenic project than it does a project about Black women's sexual self-determination. It's not about Black women being able to direct their own fertility as much as it is about a populational level effort to reduce the Black birth rate and therefore allow the possibility of Black working class progress. So in the end, I argue that actually this framework of populational level racial thinking for Du Bois is part and parcel of what is the most celebrated and most reviled aspects of his work. The most reviled being this eugenic, these eugenic elements of his work, and the most celebrated being his turn toward a socially constructed notion of race. I argue that both of these things actually come out of the way that he adopted Lamarckism for the Mendelian era.
And then the epilogue, you turn towards, the more contemporary issues here regarding impressibility. So what are your thoughts on epigenetics and how does that fit within this history that you're telling us?
Yeah, I think we're definitely seeing a return to something like a Lamarckism. You know, I mean, epigenetics and Lamarckism have distinct differences, but we've clearly reopened that idea that hereditary material can be affected over time. I'm of two minds about it. You know, I think as somebody in feminist science studies, I find the work of people like Sarah Richardson very important and influential in asking us to be really cautious about epigenetics and how it's actually been working so far just to double down on the role of women's soul and ultimate responsibility for reproduction. It's become a way of disciplining women's bodies further. You know, for example, that bulletin that the CDC put out a year ago saying that women shouldn't drink their entire period and during their entire fertile period, you know, from age 14 to 44 or whatever. The epigenetics is working to actually extend the period of a woman's lifetime of when they're considered to be actively, you know, reproducing, right? To be actively like bestowing hereditary material upon offspring from just being the period of pregnancy, but to being their entire lives. Whereas we're not even, epigenetics still isn't looking much at, say, the role of men's lifestyle on sperm, you know, at any point in their life, even like within the, you know, immediate 24-hour period of fertilization, for example. So I think that those cautions are really important. And the epigenetics, that embrace of the sort of plasticity of the gene opens up again all these possibilities for, you know, eugenic sociobiologies that we were immersed in the 19th century. But I'm not only gloomy, and that's because I think that, you know, one of the arguments of the book is that ultimately one of biopower's most salient legacies is the very practice of delineating biology from culture. That fantasy that you can separate out physiological processes from their larger environments. You know, I think that it's very important that Francis Galton also invented the phrase nature versus nurture, not only eugenics. And these are part and parcel of the same notion. And so part of me is glad that epigenetics is reopening this possibility of rethinking, you know, dynamic interactions between bodies and their environments. You know, much like we're embracing in critical theory across the social sciences and humanities as well. I think that potentially opens up new avenues for social justice. If we can better understand how economic disparity, for example, actually has physiological effect over time, I think that's actually necessary for feminist and anti-racist work. But I don't think that those models are going to come from dominant epigenetic science. I think those models are going to come from interdisciplinary thinkers with a good, solid framework in history of understanding how we can engage in this kind of biocultural thinking without just opening the door to eugenics again.
Well, Kyla, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I'm just going to ask you one last question. What are you working on now?
Yeah, I'm working. This year I'm on a fellowship at the Stanford Humanities Center, where I'm working on a next book project called Gender Studies After Gender, which really picks up on this epilogue. And I'm trying to rethink the sex-gender distinction in light of the material turn, especially to produce a book that I think we could be able to teach in our undergraduate classes in particular. That idea that sex is biology and gender is culture, it's been crumbling for decades. And yet I'm not sure we've really replaced it with a useful framework for understanding then, well, what is the difference of sex and gender? And why are we still using this framework if we no longer think that biology and culture are distinct processes? I'm arguing that when we think about sex and gender both as dynamic assemblages, but that differ at the level of scale. Sex is a dynamic assemblage of biology and culture at the level of the individual body, and gender a dynamic assemblage at the level of the group. But it's still the very beginning stages, so I'm not yet sure exactly what that's going to look like as I flesh it out.
Well, it sounds fascinating. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
So once again, I can't recommend this book enough. Kyla Schuler's book, The Biopolitics of Feeling, Race, Sex, and Science in the 19th Century. Thanks again for joining us. Goodbye.